Technorama, special interview with Larry Nemechek, a.k.a. Dr. Trek.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Hey, me up, Scotty. I'm not conditioned to fly.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here, your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If you're new to Technorama, thank you for joining us. If you're returning, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I am Chuck Tomasi, and with me as always is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I am fantastic, and I'm looking forward to today's episode.
This is exciting. This is somebody we've known for a while. I met him in person at Phoenix Comic Con this past summer and have just been chomping at the bit to get some time on our calendar, get the interview engine up and run, the interview engine's back online.
Here he is, and we got it. It's working.
It is. So let's jump into it. Welcome to Technorama, Larry. Why don't you start by telling the listener who is Larry Nemechek?
Wow, guys. Well, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me on. Larry Nemechek. It all started a little 5,000-watt radio station. And
that's true.
That's for any surviving fans of Mary Tyler Moore there.
Yeah.
The show, Ted Baxter. I was born in Oklahoma, had way too many interests, including history and sci-fi and a lot of science geeky things, and my hero, Will Rogers. And when I was a kid, became a Star Trek fan on top of a lot of other things. And through, you know, high school and college and getting a theater degree and a news degree, a news minor, wound up working in that, but always being a Star Trek fan. And the long and the short of it is, through crazy ways, wound up getting to Los Angeles thanks to Star Trek and writing and my interest in background and fandom and in backgrounding, which has always attracted me even more than just like the actors and the stories and all of that. Both the canon and the production end of it increasingly. So a lot of my stuff, you know, everybody has their first passion splurge of fandom when you hit something new, especially when you're young. And mine all went into the tech manual and Bijou's Concordance and the medical reference manual and all the original blueprints and all of that world just totally turned me on. And we have to finish this. We have to fill this out. And of course, we only had, you know, the original 79 episodes then. So, but feeling like you were in Oklahoma and all the exciting stuff was happening in New York and L.A. and somewhere else. But, you know, fandom grew up and we did conventions and had clubs and also, you know, went to school. I had one experience where I thought it was going to be in a nationally published bit, and I was, but it was as an homage, and I kind of got ripped out of it, which was a real downer, and I, which is the original Star Trek maps, which have a Nemechek star in them, which kind of astounds people, but kind of set me back on my heels, and I was like, well, fine, I'll get back in the real world and get back with, you know, going to school and making money. And then when Next Generation came out, and desktop publishing and Macs were kind of revolutionizing everything, I did my own version of Bijou's Concordance for Next Generation, which now we have the encyclopedia, which just came out. But before the encyclopedia and before Memory Alpha Online and before wikis in general, and Bijou was kind of, you know, like so much of Star Trek, you know, writing the book, setting a template there. I wanted to do that for Next Generation and take my chance to jump in on the new generation of everything. And 4 or 5 annual editions later, it got noticed at Paramount, and I got offered the chance to do the Next Generation Companion, which, you know, wasn't an encyclopedia. It was a making of. And then all I could see was, oh, my God, I'm supposed to do, you know, like Stephen, the making of Star Trek. I'm supposed to do that book in 3 months. Oh, my God. But survived that. And and from there, got to do things like edit the Communicator magazine, the official magazine, for 8 years and work on the international fact files and become a go-to guy in licensing for archival projects and work on the Star Trek experience in Vegas. And my wife got to work on Voyager for 5 years through our contacts after we moved to L.A. and in the writers. She was assistant script coordinator. And just, you know, getting trusted by the whole Star Trek, professional Star Trek world at the, you know, the next gen Voyager DS9 Enterprise era, and being a front row seat for my own stuff, as well as the communicator and fact files and all those projects, and talking, you know, I'd always gone to conventions and then became a convention guest and would share behind the scenes things. And then it all blew up in 2005 on so many levels. and the internet and digital world were changing things. And so since then, it's been an interesting thing of kind of finding our way as, oh, I don't know, this podcast revolution and,
right,
you know, everything was as big as self-publishing was, you know, back in the day, all the media with the fan films and podcasting and you know, blogging and having your own video channel and being entrepreneuring. And that's kind of what I've tried to carve out here while there was no active Star Trek. And now we're back into active Star Trek. So things are picking up a little bit, still not the big machine that it was. And so much of the rest of the pop culture world that, you know, that Star Trek helped launch, that were, right, you know, this is the era of superheroes and all that. So, but yeah, somewhere between that and the world, you know, how real space is finally starting to move forward here in exciting ways. And so the last few years, my marketing friends said you have to blog and entrepreneur yourself. And so, hi, it's Dr. Trek and welcome to Trekland. But a lot of stuff that was organic, like my little column that I wrote in our club newsletter years ago, it was called Ask Dr. Trek, but it was never Q&A like I thought it would be, like I used to do with the old Well Committee. And what I do in my column now with the magazine, but for ages, but it turned into just kind of a news, here's what's going on, because I'm getting the spoilers mailers from Paramount on Next Generation. So I went back to that and Trek, when I would used to go down the line and say, well, I'm an author, I'm an editor, I'm a host, I'm a pundit, I'm an announcer, I've done acting. I finally just gave up and I said, well, hi, I'm Larry and I work in Trekland, or I'm from Trekland. So I just did that as a coverall. So I can still go back and say that. So I, you know, I've got some things going on now, including Portal 47 that I'm very proud of launching last year, but I still kind of stick with that and it still kind of works. And, so it's just incredible how, on one hand, Star Trek and its fandom has changed, and how Star Trek and its fandom is still the same, you know, no matter what's going on with the world and what cool little way we're connecting up with each other, you know,
right,
that we're doing now. So that's kind of where I came in. And hopefully, again, I'm not a one trick pony, but I love history, and I'm, Jesus, this political year has sucked me in like it always does.
Yep.
And connected to all of this, outside of that, I'm a huge football fan. I love my Oklahoma Sooners. And I'm a big Will Rogers fan, I mentioned, and he's kind of my hero. And I could not do this at home, but the other pole of Will Rogers-ness is here in L.A., the Santa Monica Ranch that is now a state park, historic state park, where his ranch house was. And I'm a docent out there and enjoy giving tours and that kind of thing. So,
that is cool.
Yeah. So there's kind of a, you know, when I was a kid, I collected stamps and did model trains and built models and did model rocketry and all the nerdy, goofy stuff like that. But you know, since then I've worked in news, had won two state AP awards when I was at our paper back in Norman, and before we moved out here to La La Land. And it's been kind of, I can't believe that's been 20 years. Hey guys, I have this horrible reputation of being a rambler, so cut me off when it hurts. But I have to say, that's like got to be the shortest biography of Nemechek you'll ever hear. From my mouth, anyway.
That's what they do in Oklahoma, isn't it? Ramble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I have to, you know, I'm imagine. That's my older brother's word.
There's an intervention group for people like you. It's called On and On and On.
Right. You're hilarious,
Chuck. Your touch point on the election inspired me to think of how would it, it's like what would Jesus do moments, or what would Gene do moments, yeah, how he would often fold in the events or issues of the day into an episode. And I'm thinking we could have a Star Trek episode where there's an election and nobody likes the candidates. What would happen?
We're trying to elect the president for the United Federation of Planets,
and nobody likes the presidential candidates.
Because of the and then it turns out that one of the candidates was actually a hologram that had some anti-scanning program built into it,
and the other one's been sending illegal mail to the Cardassians or something.
That just killed me. Like, I don't keep up with them. I grew up not keeping up with them. I mean, I grew up reading the novels until it got to a certain point in the height of Trekness, like in the 90s, where it's like I couldn't poison my mind with non-canon novels because I had to keep it clear for all the canonicity that was being, you know, poured out every week from two shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I got all that. Same thing with the early games. But I know all the authors, and I know how awesome the novels are, and how they, since the Fallow time, they've kind of cut back on the novels, but just made them incredible and interwoven across the, you know, the genres and the series. So I love the novels, even though I haven't read them, which makes no sense. But I don't know this off for a fact, although there's memory beta out there. If anybody has taken just the mundane level of politics in Star Trek, like we were just talking about the Federation president and, you know, exactly how, what is a seat on the council? What is that exactly? Is that like a, is that like the Security Council is for the United Nations and it's not everybody, but, or is it everybody? Or I don't know that anybody's ever fleshed that out. Or
that would be an interesting backstory.
There's another companion you can write.
Yeah. Right. But which will immediately be contradicted by something in Discovery, I'm sure, like second season. Oh, well, great. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Well, let's go back into the history archives. How did you get started with Star Trek? Were you watching live when Star Trek, we won't even refer to it as TOS because we'll just say Star Trek because that's what it was called.
Yeah. Yes.
You were watching that live or did you catch it in syndication?
No. I was a rerun baby.
Okay.
In fact, I talk about how I vaguely was aware of some space show with a guy with ears on it when I was a kid, but I didn't. My older brother ran the TV, and I remember Lost in Space being on, just generically, you know, and playing a Will and the Robot at school at recess, you know, kind of a thing. But it was well into rerun era, and my ninth grade science teacher they were kidding around one day, and she was like first year teacher and young, and the long shot of it was, I just always remember her looking at me kind of disappointed, sadly disappointed, like, oh, I've let her down. And she was like, oh, Larry, don't tell me you don't watch Star Trek. And I'm like, is that show with the guy with the ears? And she's like, go home. Of course, it was after school on every day. She's like,
here's
go
your
home
homework.
Today. Here's your homework. Yeah. She didn't say that. She's like, go home right now and watch that tonight. And it's like, oh, okay. So I said, and here's where my head was. This is when it was still on the animateds were still on. I said, wait. Isn't there like an animated version of it? And she's like, yeah. I said, well, I think I'll watch the animated version to see if I like it before I. It was so, like, what is the logic in that? I'm going to invest my 30 minutes on a cartoon before I see if the live action hour is any good.
It's your extensive research.
That's what my head was. Don't ask me why. But I specifically remember thinking that. And then, you know, and then I watched, I didn't even see Yesteryear. It was like Beyond the Farthest Star or something. But it was something about that. And then, you know, I think the first one I actually saw was, I can remember the floaty energy ball going down. So it must have been Day of the Dove. But after something, after two or three or four shows just clicked that, oh, my God, this is such a, you know, now we have all the buzzwordy terms. Oh, it's a cinematic universe. You know, it's a cohesive, you know.
Right.
But back at the time, it was like, oh, my God, this is a world. And it's funny how when you're a kid, self-analyze yourself, but 20 years later, you're struggling to try to figure out how to label things and do that. But it was like, eventually it was the background of the show, the canon background and the production background later. But at first it was the canon background of the show. Like I didn't stop to think about it then, but when we would play or when I got a little older and we would actually like go out to our treehouse and do stuff, or I would build things, you wanted to build that universe and you wanted to play, you know, you wanted to, now we'd say role play that, but you wanted to go out and play like that universe. Mm-hmm. And it's like you could climb into your TV and know exactly, even the parts that you didn't see on screen in some shows, you could climb through your TV and be in that world and you knew exactly what it was like and how you would be. And that was back when nobody did that back then, you know, that was before Star Wars even. And
yeah.
And it was such a revolution. And the whole thing of the hopeful, optimistic future and commentary and all that, I know I was, my mind was ripe for that, and my own philosophical, you know, political bent was ripe for that. But it's like something I think since like Leonard died, it's kind of like I've realized how much I just took so many parts of Star Trek for granted. But back then it was kind of like, well, yeah, of course we'll go from caves to small city states to countries to a unified world to a union of unified planets. It's like, well, of course that's what we'll do, you know?
Right.
Of course we won't blow ourselves up and kill ourselves. If we do, we won't be around to talk about it. So let's
hope right.
we don't. I mean, you know, it was just kind of like, well, duh. Yeah, of course. And it's like so many people, I got into, you know, like later on when people would write their fanzine stories, and I was never a fiction person. God bless them. And there's some obvious and fiction is what built Star Trek fandom, fanzines, and the fanzine, which was mostly female. So, you know, take that, fanboys. But you know, right. clubs and conventions came out of the fanzine world. And that was how Star Trek was first brought, thanks to Spock. And that's what, you know, saved Star Trek really in the beginning. But and the people watching after school on these stations at first would put the show on after school for kids. And then the ratings blew up and more stations did that and all that. But yeah, it's kind of like all this stuff that I took Star Trek for granted for. Well, yeah. And now going back but I would see other people writing about it. And it was like, why are you spending 10 pages with this essay? It's like, well, of course that's what it is. Why do you have to like say that and get it out? And I didn't realize that people, that's what affected a lot of people. My thing, like I said, my thing was, oh my God, where are all these missing pages in the tech manual? We need a page for the, you know, ship phasers. We need a page. Yeah. They're not pages for everything. You've got this contents outline here, and oh my God, look at all this loose stuff in the Concordance. Look at all these stars and planets. They're just not related, and some of them are real. This should be organized. And that was, you know, my first driving thing. So Star Trek affects everybody differently, and it still does. And on one hand, we're all one big happy fleet of fandom, but on the other hand, God bless fandom. It's all, you know, today, this day, the news, we have good news come out. And we have the internet and everything and social media to amplify it. So on one way, it's so much more amplified and magnified than it was, you know, in the '70s and the '80s and all that. But on the other hand, fandom is still fandom. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, really, really? There's like 5-10% here griping about this or you're what? Like if 2 years ago, if I'd said you could have new Star Trek episodes for $6 a month, of course you would have said, hell yeah. And now people are watching about it. I'm like, what?
And hey, then
people are griping about Brian Fuller coming and being the showrunner. And then when he steps back, they're griping that he's leaving. I'm just like, oh, I'd say I give up, but I don't really. But I
oh, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, well, it's an amazing world.
Yeah, you'll find that everywhere. Hey, I rolled a 7. No, that's a, you know,
yeah,
that's a 6. No, it's a 9. So, yeah. Well, let's follow along in your Trek career a little bit. And I think you mentioned a moment ago about the Star Trek experience. So what was your involvement there?
Well, I mean, a ton of people worked on that and it evolved. I'm not taking any huge, you know, I'm one of 20 or 50 people or whatever, but what I did was I got to, not anything to do with the ride, but the actual hands-on museum part of the experience. Were you guys there? Did you ever get to go?
We actually took the backstage tour. It was and we recorded the whole thing, and we couldn't release it until they actually closed it. So yes, I've been through it a couple times, and then we did our Backstreet video. We can send you a link to it with April Abair.
Yeah,
she was great, and we have a little bit of history with it ourselves.
April was the most awesome person to take that tour with. That's great. I had at the time I got to do it was like going in as editor of communicator or whatever, as a VIP or something. And the manager at the time, who was really sweet and was not the one that it wound up with. Her name was Dana Blackburn, but she was great. And we took a picture of me leaning over. Well, here's the thing. So when they were building it, you know, there was the ride component, and originally it was just the ride.
Yep.
The Klingon encounter was the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't get a name until the Borg invasion came along, and then they had to give the ride a ride name. But originally, there was the ride component, and then there was, you know, the quirks and the stores, the retail and the eating, and then there was the museum part. And what I worked on was the museum. I wrote all the plaques for the museum.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then I did notes on the first pass of all the signage, you know, the information boards and everything that was up. I helped look at the, I helped like fact check them, and I knew the archives better than anyone at the time. And this is before, this is 96 and 97. So this is before we had digital and, you know, screen grabbing was all like in its infancy and was really expensive. So, we were using like the stock, the library of images, which is a lot of what I did with a lot of things back then. But, I helped pull out images or get the best things and fix those boards, hopefully, so that they weren't, you know, there was nothing out of line. But yeah, so that was that. And then when we did the one time, there was a redo when Enterprise came out, and there was new, you know, especially around its time, new information from the end of Vulcan First Contact through the Archer era.
Yeah,
I got to write the timeline boards because originally that was written from Mike and Denise's. They didn't do it, but it was done from the chronology book. But I wrote the patch. There were like two new panels we stuck in the middle there. And pulled the images for those and had those done. So,
Nemechek meets the first Vulcans and greets them on Earth. What's this in here for? I'm kidding.
And then shoots them.
Oh, you alternate universe guys. Oh, wait, that's the mirror universe.
Yes.
It's the most, if there was ever a prime alternate universe, it's mirror universe. I was very proud of being able to do that.
This is Vernon Wilmer, Star Trek The Experience's Borg Drone 7 of 16. Why are you listening to Technorama? Because resistance is futile.
So one thing that was cool was, you know how on the buttons on consoles, Mike Okuda and anybody else over from Next Generation onward, they would put like people's initials on the buttons.
Yeah.
Well, when they, I got on the first movie, Enterprise E, I guess First Contact, the engineering console, I had initials on that, but there was initials. My initials were on a button on the tactical horseshoe, and they, when I took the tour with Dana, she had me pose and point to my button on the thing, which never got out. They put it up in their employee room, and I thought it was lost forever, but then I found a picture of it later. Somebody that worked there, Vernon Wilmer, who's kind of the archivist of the experience.
We've spoken with Vernon. Yes.
Vernon's awesome. And he found that picture. So it's not a lost picture. I have it. Nobody else cares, but.
Oh, we care.
Yeah. Oh, thanks guys.
And we're happy to know that you were behind a lot of that stuff that we enjoyed very, very much. How have you been?
It's just so sad that it's gone, but I was one of many, many people, but, it was an awesome thing, and it's just sad it's gone. We just need an experience type attraction back to be a mecca again.
I would love that.
There was talk about moving a lot of that stuff to Fremont Street. Did that ever happen, or what's going on there?
It did. That was a guy that they thought at the time was going to rush in, and he had a space, and it just didn't work out. It was like right after the crash, he thought he had the financing went away, but it was more a matter of kind of a simplistic idea than a reality. He thought they would pull some pieces over and open up something and add to it later. And that wound up not happening at all. And that's when you had the auction of the pieces there finally.
Once the museum's disassembled, it's tough to put back together.
I mean, CBS, he had license and people were hoping to rush and put something up to be, but it was in the time when people were just like really in the weeds and wandering in the wilderness about what Star Trek was going to be and who would what would be the next major iteration. Because this was, you know, it was like 07. It was like 08, 09.
Yep.
And and even with the movie coming, it was like a 1-2-hour movie. And what would that turn into? And there's not enough in a 2-hour movie to stake a whole design, you know, motif of planning a whole ton of money. And so it was going to be a while before anybody was at that stage. So it was going to be a get by or maybe a transition, you know, stepping stone bridge. But between the movie not setting the world on fire in a big way and in the economic, you know, and it wasn't just about having money in Vegas. And it was like, can anybody come to Vegas to go see it? You know,
sure.
Anybody have money to travel?
It was kind of a
down time. Yeah.
Okay.
So no, that didn't ever go. But they're out there looking. People are still trying to, you know, the touring type. You know, events are still happening and got ramped up for the 50th, but Hopefully we'll have something.
Speaking of the 50th, as we record this, 2016, this is the 50th anniversary. We just passed it a couple of months ago. How have you been spending the 50th anniversary?
Well, you know, I got to
watch Babylon 5. I'm kidding. Yeah,
yeah. Because isn't it ironic, don't you think? Yeah. No, I mean, on one hand, you know, enjoying and being part of all the this huge outbreak of 50th anniversary, all the conventions from Vegas down. And I sent you all of them. I didn't get to go to I was trying to get there and wound up being at another place to spread the 50th cheer at Salt Lake. But I didn't make the mission New York. But, you know, Vegas is an annual event. A guy named Terrace Cassidy, who has a company called Geek Nation Tours, came to me about 5 years ago before 2012 about doing a Star Trek location tour as part of his arsenal of awesome tours of all kinds of niche tours, historical and military and pop culture things. And we started doing that. And this year we did the biggest tour ever. We didn't just do L.A. filming sites the week before the Las Vegas convention. We went up to finally to San Francisco, which I'd wanted to do for a long time, and did that. So, and we had twice as big a tour as we'd had in our prior to incarnations. So, you know, it's like, here's the thing. I saw some person, some well-meaning little blog writer on one of the major sites, news writer, wrote a piece about how CBS and Paramount had botched, quote unquote, the 50th anniversary. And I thought, like, what planet do you live on? Because there were more, and it seemed to be the gist of the story was there wasn't a 50th anniversary TV special or something weird. Well, there was a 2 hour special from the History Channel. There was a 2 hour special from the Smithsonian, I think, tied in with the you know the Air and Space remodeling and unveiling of the original Enterprise filming model, which was awesome and long overdue. But you know there were TV specials, but there were more conventions, more special events, the touring shows. There were mainstream tie-ins. They brought the refurbished Galileo shuttle from the NASA museum in Houston to the Intrepid Museum in New York and made a big splash there.
They refurbished the original model of the Enterprise in the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
That's what I was talking about. The Smithsonian was involved and did a special on that. Did a History Channel did a 2 hour special. There were more conventions. There was more mainstream talk. I thought CBS and CBS Consumer Products did an incredible job because at the beginning, nobody knew Discovery was coming and they thought the only big splashy thing was going to be
Beyond.
Right. And not knowing how that would go over. And, you know, and it was rushed. It was yanked and redone with a new bunch. And as it turned out, I thought Beyond was the best of the three movies. But
I enjoyed it a lot. Yes.
But before even Discovery became a news event and added to the pile of headlines, licensing had been working on a lot of, and of course there were new books and a lot of fun crossover, you know, comics and a lot of the novels and did these Trek talks. So I don't know where this thing is that it was, but I thought that, the Comic-Con San Diego, which is the granddaddy of Comic-Cons, right? And Star Trek's peak years, the foam years, were before the Comic-Con era, right? So this was the big, I mean, they engineered from Spock on the cover of the Major Guide on the artsy Spock, this 50th artist, 50th artworks exhibit that's touring around, the Mac makeup license, which is very mainstream. This was the biggest footprint and the biggest splash at, you know, Granddaddy Comic-Con in San Diego that has ever happened. So I don't know how. I mean, Star Trek was more out in fandom circles and also more out in the mainstream than ever before. So I don't know where this came by about it being, you know, I thought they did an incredible job on the 50th. And obviously no human being could be everywhere, but it was a thrill because not just the big specialty conventions, but almost every small convention had a spotlight on the 50th, fan or professional. And I got to be part of a lot of that. And I, you know, this year's Trekland on Speaker CD, which is a remastered series from I've got over 500 hours of long form sit down talks with people from the 80s and 90s and aughts that were the creators on Star Trek when it was happening, like the writers and designers. And I obviously wasn't there in the 60s, but, in 20 years ago, and we just had the anniversary of Trials and Tribulations, which was awesome. But 20 years ago, I decided to do this year's edition on flashback and trials and tribulations. So the 30th anniversary homages, you know, so I called it 30 at 50. But I went back to my stage visits and pulled those conversations and remastered them. And that's it's a series I've done now in its fifth year. And I always debut the new one at Vegas and CD that people can get at my site. But so it was cool to hear Grace Lee Whitney and you know, Ron Moore and all those people talking again about it. But mm-hmm. I know it's Star Trek is, we talk about anniversaries. It's such a meta level because we've had prior anniversaries. It's like, you know, every time we roll over, it's hard not to have a year that's an anniversary of something,
right?
In Star Trek. But the 50th really was a turning point, and far from, I kind of mentioned it before, far from being kind of a downbeat year, because the year before we lost Leonard and Harve Bennett and Grace Lee Whitney, and it was kind of like, for a while, it was like, geez, we're going to even stagger into the 50th of everybody.
Right.
But it kind of started getting across a reexamination, like I said, are we taking Star Trek for granted? Have I taken Star Trek for granted? Well, yeah, duh, it's Star Trek.
Yeah,
that way. And I don't know. It kind of got the year early for me. Of course, I told people they should start partying because The Cage, the first pilot, was done in 64. So you really could have started partying in 2014. But anyway, so yeah, it's been an awesome time. And I think it's been great to have. I think it's been a great job of Star Trek being out in the mainstream again and people. Not just for what it is, which is incredible, you know, the whole Roddenberry vision and the inspirational hope and the fun pop culture and the celebrating science and rationality, the way that The Martian, you know, did in a way, but just what it meant for the industry and entertainment and fandom and pop culture. And, you know, Star Trek, we had the internet with paper and stamps and mimeographs before the, you know, we were demanding the internet before that, and Star Trek was demanding social media before there was a social media. I mean, it and set the bar for Star Wars and everything to come with fandoms and pop culture genres and all this stuff that we have now before we had buzzwordy terms for it was what Star Trek unleashed on us in all these different ways. So it's just, you know, pick a level. You can go talk about it.
You'd mentioned, you know, how we lost Grace Lee Whitney and Leonard. And I think that's really caused us to reflect and appreciate it more. I watched For the Love of Spock recently and thought that was more information than I knew about Leonard Nimoy and his career ever. And it was wonderfully done by his son, Adam, and can't be more thankful. Yeah. But to get to the to keep the anniversary thing going alive, it's coming up on the anniversary of Khan of Wrath. Where are we? First, for the listener who may not be aware, explain Khan of Wrath and what the significance of the anniversary is.
Well, thank you for asking. I feel like I've been talking about this for so long that everybody does know and they're tired of hearing about it. But
moving along. I'm kidding.
You're right. Come to think of it, you're right.
Oh, look at the time.
Oh, gee. No, the Khan of Wrath was the, not my title, but it was the fan-given nickname to an event that happened. It was really the first, literally the first big rock show, first mega event outside of just a regular convention. Again, which Star Trek kind of, you know, took site, the old sci-fi lit cons, which we still have, and turned them on their ear because it was the first big, huge media ongoing franchise property that people felt compelled that they needed a convention just on their own for Star Trek. And, you know, the New York cons in 72, the famous first one, 500 people turned into 5,000 or whatever, 3,000. So only 10 years into that, it had matured to the point where with Wrath of Khan, the movie was going to be so exciting and so big that a guy who did conventions in Houston, you know, in 30-something guy named Jerry Wilhite and his coterie of people who did cons dreamed this big dream of having a show, an actual show in an arena where Nichelle could sing with an orchestra and Walter could write a play and they would act it out and all of this. So they dreamed this big dream, thought they had this huge mega event, had the entire cast there, except for Leonard Nimoy, not without a reason in its own story. And as we say in the byline, things did not quite go as they were supposed to. And it also turned out that it was my first big roadshow convention to go to when I was a kid. So June 82. And it was a wacky doodle thing that happened, incredible, but like so much stuff, it just kind of happened. And we don't think about, you know, the snapshot in time that it represents or what it is until years later. And 5-6 years ago, I was at an after party to our old home con back home, SoonerCon, and ran into a guy. I heard him talking about Houston, and the fans were calling it. It had such a meltdown, a crazy meltdown, and yet still happened anyway. Impact on people that by the end of the weekend, they were saying, hey, guys, we survived the Con of Wrath, you know, because the movie was only 2 weeks out. And it was fun. And it files away in your memory. And then about 6 years ago, I ran into the guy who was the tech manager of the stage. And I just had this huge light bulb moment because I said, hey, I've been trying not to just be a word guy. And every time I'd start to do something with media, it didn't pan out. But here's something I could do myself. This needs to be preserved and recorded. And no, not just recorded. It needs to be on camera. And I bet this would be a documentary. And then when Harv Bennett and Walter both said yes, because they were kind of the key ringleaders, saving it, putting it together and then saving it on the ground, I said, okay. And I also knew that I could do this with people in Houston when I found that so many people were still all together as a group, or at least geographically, and then the LA people. And I thought, if I can just base it on those two and then maybe add to it, I can do it on a micro budget and at least preserve this, but maybe save the story and then do some spin-off things about fandom then and now and how they're similar and how they're different. And it was going to be a laid back project, which is why it's been 5-6 years. Rod Roddenberry just looked at me and said, just don't take 8 years like his Trek Nation did. So hopefully we'll not break that record, but yeah, this year I'm trying to wrap it up. We're aiming to be out next year. So it's a documentary. Harv, bless his heart, passed away last year, but we got him in 2011. It was his last camera interview. Harv and George Takei and Walter Koenig and Nichelle Nichols are all in it. Wendy Doohan speaks for Jimmy. Couple more I'm working on. We finally, its own little inner saga, the guy who was in the middle of this, who kind of took it hard and got blamed for a lot, kind of went underground for a while into his friends. And then kind of came back, reemerged a few years thanks to Facebook, and then and at first didn't trust us, thought we were just stirring up some trouble, but I finally got across to him that I saw it as a Phoenix story, and kind of I said it was like a riches to rags to riches story, and I did not want to come in and talk about the downside, except as the texture of the story. It was amazing, kind of a wacky doodle story, and a great way to say things about Star Trek and pop culture and where how we're the same and how we're different now. And he came around, and then he had a horrible health situation the last couple of years. But anyway, he finally got back, and we just spent last weekend, 3 hours with him, where I didn't even know what turns the story would take, what the frame would be and the tone. And it's changed for me over the years. I didn't mean to be 60 minutes about it, but we've even found some villains that had to do with it, but weren't about the planners and Jerry in the middle. So it's been, they always say, if you do a documentary, start off with a premise, but don't be, be prepared to go where, just like a police investigation, be prepared to go where the clues and the footage takes you. And that's kind of been the odyssey. But the other hand, and I haven't had crowdfunding for it, but I've had a PayPal donation page set up at conofrath.com. But yeah, it's been a winding road, and I didn't set out to do it in 3 months or 6 months. So especially now that Adam Nimoy did the documentary about his father, I'm glad I didn't aim for the 50th year. So we're aiming for next year, and it's going to be a crunch this spring and winter. But that's the plan.
I look forward to seeing that.
People can say everywhere I go to convention, I do a live 2-hour event, which is kind of be called the Dr. Trek Show. But it's a way for people to, they want to crowdfund $20 and get their little screen credit, they can, but it's me live and I do prize trivia and we have rare Trek video. And then I also have sneak peeks from the dock with George and Walter and Harv and Wendy and Michelle talking. And it's like a 2-hour thing I do usually late night on Saturdays. And the two cons that the last two of the year are coming up here. One that's like this weekend, which I don't know if your turnaround will catch it. Albany, which is the first time up there, and then Starbase Indy in Indianapolis, which is latter part of Thanksgiving weekend, and then anything into the spring that's going on, I'll be doing it there. But yeah, that's a place where people can come and get a taste live and hear me talk some more. And but the PayPal page is still up, and so if you want to, you can go higher. Point, obviously. And if people were there, that's the other thing. If people were survivors, I call them, fellow survivors. It's not too late to jump. It's the window is closing, and I'm trying to get down my list here because it's not just the actors. It's the crew that put it on and the dealers who also had a hand in saving.
Participants, yep.
And the fans who were there. Yep. And there's some great little wacky doodle sidebar stories that have come up. That's part of this. It wasn't just the meta story of the thing. It's everything from the exploding weather balloon to the Shatner stalker girl to, I mean, it's some, you know, all kinds of wacky history that alongside it. And so it'll be a fun and it's something I hope will be better than just the con circuit. It'll be great for the con circuit, but I really hope of human nature, you know, and us and us then and now in it, that it'll transcend that a little bit in the festival circuit, and it just documentary people will, you know, pop culture people will love, human nature fans will love some of it too.
See, you should bring it and screen it at Dragon Con.
That might be too late. That's not till Labor Day.
Just saying.
We'll be having it. We'll find ways to have different premieres and different screenings. No, I would love to be. I've only got to come to Dragon Con twice, once when the companion, you know, the final edition came out, and once I just came on my own. So
We're like a 6 or 7 year, I don't remember now, veteran.
Eight, something like that.
Okay. Well, if you have any friends at Comic-Con, tell them to reach out that are doing that kind of thing. Tell them to reach out.
Hi, this is Grant Imahara from Mythbusters, and Myth Confirmed. You're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
So you've talked a lot about fanfic, and I've got, you know where this is going. I'm sure, I hope. Your involvement with New Voyages and Star Trek Continues, a couple of my favorite online, how did you get involved with these? And tell us a little bit in the background of your involvement. I know you obviously played Dr. McCoy in one of them.
Yeah, well, the early one, New Voyages, back when fan films were new and, you know, they didn't even have YouTube and Vimeo. They just put an act at a time up and everybody would, you know, modem download it. And it'd take an hour to get 10 minutes of video. That's how far this has come.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and the fact that we've come so far is why the fan films have exploded. But, yeah, fan films are like the fanzines of the 70s, and because we can, you know, people can do whole movies on their laptop. And, you know, James Colley came up to me. He was visiting the art departments back when there was such a thing, when we had actual shows, Enterprise era. And we had done a story on Starship Exeter, which was the first of the modern fan films, right?
Mm-hmm. That
the
Johnson brothers did.
Mm-hmm. And, they had done most of the first one on location and avoided sets, and they had used his bridge set for their bridge. And he was upset that a caption said something about on their bridge. And I said, well, it was the bridge set they used. And he was wanting us to, you know, run a correction or something. And I said, well, because he was very proud of his set. And I said, well, how about we just do a story do your own story? And he was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they were filming the first New Voyage. I start to say Indie Image. No, that's the real phase two.
Right.
The titles escape me, but they're what they call their pilot now. What really looked like a fan film. Anyway, I was on screen as a cameo there, and which was a crazy story in itself. But I had no idea what fan films were good. I had no idea that I did that, and then they got it out finally, and then. I was around the lot and in some of the, you know, some of the writers' offices, and some of the assistants were like, hey, Cal, I saw you. I'm like, oh, my God, you saw that? And they're like, of course, there's like a million people have downloaded that. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, good. Hope it was decent. I was a little paranoid about it because I hadn't acted in years. But no, that was that. And then had the chance to be a Tellarite. Was originally going to be in the Walter episode as a Tellarite. And then then they made one of the Klingons, the Klingon spy became a Tellarite in that short vignette that John Kerrigan. The Klingon Kobayashi Maru is what it was. And no, it was an awesome 3-hour full-blown Tellarite makeup job. And I have it like on video and pictures and everything.
Wow.
And it was almost lost with most of the vignettes, and John kind of rescued the pieces and shepherded it and got it done. So that's out there. But then, you know, like flash forward, Vic Mignogna's putting, you know, his passion project, which is just kind of taken over the internet and taken over pop culture. Mm-hmm. All the fan films, and I've tried to, and I've supported all the fan films if they were worth supporting. And I mean, you know, there's been one, not even Axanar, but there was one that was a little on the shady side that wasn't put together well. But most of the time it's fans trying to, you know, just doing their passion on some level or other, whether it's just, they're just out in their garage and you can tell, but it, you know, you love it because it's fans, or it's something is insanely
this
good.
This set's made out of cardboard.
Yeah, for real. And Christmas lights and plywood. Yeah. Or it's something as awesome as Continues turned out to be, which I had no idea. But yeah, on 3 weeks' notice, Ralph Miller, who did audio for a lot of Phase 2 and was going to do audio for this sound recording, they came up, Chuck Huber was going to play McCoy at the beginning and then suddenly couldn't. And and no one knew for how long or for, you know, exactly what. And on 3 weeks' notice, Ralph had said, Vic, as much as you love Kirk, Larry loves McCoy. And I guess that impressed him. He's talked about that. And on 3 weeks' notice, at the very same time, I had the chance to do Stellar Cartography, which was the new title that just came out a couple of years ago, the Matt book set. It was like When It Rains, It Pours. So I was down in Southeast Georgia, badly unprepared and up late at night working on Stellar Cartography while we were shooting during the day. So if I look tired in that, that's why. But it was just an awesome experience. A great bunch of people. Shot two as McCoy, just to be standing there and doing surgery in that incredible sick bay set. And the professionalism of these quote unquote amateurs, you know, or moonlighting people, was just incredible. But yeah, what Continues is unleashed upon the world and for the good, starting with the story, you know, the props and costumes and all the fanboy stuff, girl stuff is awesome. But as Vic says, it all starts with story. And the amount of people that wanted to get involved to direct and to write and to come crew, and the way he's been able to, you know, not just convince a lot of working actors who are notable in pop culture circles, you know, genre circles, not only convince them to come do it, but the ones who want to come and be in, because it's such a quality production, they don't mind having it on their reel, on their, you know, on their demo, on their credit.
Yeah.
So it's amazing what that's become. So, you know, I'm very, very proud to have been McCoy in the first couple. I would have liked to have gone on. I would have liked to put more into it, but I had a documentary that wasn't getting built and I had a new business I was trying to do called Portal 47. And we just plunged in. It became so huge. And Chuck wanted to come back and do McCoy. And he and Vic had been friends for 20 years, you know, acting and voice acting. So it was just kind of a mutually agreed upon thing for me to do that. But they wanted me to be involved. And so I've been creative consultant, which means I get calls from James Kerwin at 1 a.m. You know, Larry, what do Telluride's think about women? And
hey, can you explain that that Heisenberg compensator again?
Yeah. Well, James, and it's not like I'm the only nerd in the circle. Okay.
Right.
It's there's plenty of that going on with half those people who have crew titles are good at that. But there's times when they bounce things off me, and that's kind of what that is. Yeah.
Yeah. I think
times when I've weighed in and said, I don't know. And a couple of times I lose one. I still think they should have said races, not species, because species is like a, you know, but a lot of what I do is retcon, you know, canon in my column in the magazine and just in general. It's what I've always done. It's like, no, don't talk about how this was a, you know, was a misnomer or a boner or a mistake. Let's use that for texture. Let's have that be the exception that proves the rule. Let's smooth that out. And been able to do that. There was a lot of consternation about what the story they wanted to tell in the Lolani with the Orion and slave women. Mm-hmm. And somebody woke up and said, oh my God, in Enterprise, they'd say it's the women really controlling the men. You know, and I'm like, no, just, you know. And so the explanations in the story about how there was a cultural revolution.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of having a middle ground, it went from one to the other. I said, look, guys, it's 100 years apart. You know, like, there's plenty of time to pull something.
Stuff can happen, yeah.
So that's the and I said, you know, it's like, why does anybody have to be a slave to the other? And Vic said, that's not only a great explanation line, it's a great McCoy line. And if you watch Lolani, McCoy, Spock is giving all the background and McCoy says, well, why does anybody have to be a slave to anybody?
Yeah. And, I think I remember. That.
Yeah. So that's been an awesome little place to be. So, I miss being McCoy, but I don't miss the insanity, and I'm glad I got to develop my other stuff. So, and I got to be McCoy on Red Shirt Diaries, if you, in a wacky way. So,
oh, cool.
If you've ever seen that little, they've ended it now, but it was a wonderful little set of shorts that Ashley V. Robinson and Jason Inman did. Well, anyway, just go check it out.
There's we'll have to go back and look at that.
Yeah.
They've ended it now, but it lasted for a season. There's about 27, 28 episodes, and I'm in, like, in the next to last one getting to play McCoy.
Larry, what is in the pipeline right now? What are you working on that we can look forward to?
You've hinted at some of these. So many things are like things that need to be finished. So Con of Wrath, conofwrath.com is trying to wrap it up. But it's not too late for people to let me know if they were there or, you know, on a very small way or a large way, be a funder and have a credit. More conventions. Enterprise in Space is something I wanted to mention too, a shout out. It's a nonprofit global thing for students K through postgrad to compete to put projects on this actual orbiter that was custom designed through a contest, and also partnered up with about 15 aerospace companies that are partnering and entities like the Smithsonian Science Center. Mm-hmm. So hopefully with some grants and awards to come, but also a crowdfunding part. Component to it. You put in $20 and your name is on a chip and you can fly aboard the first real Enterprise in Space. So it's a way to honor the future and honor young minds changing, and also people honoring. Started with a fan who got an awesome team of people together, NASA contractors and people who have built huge projects, and the NASA's Educator of the Year twice, who's won awards, and her team on the education outreach to students and teachers part of it. So it's all these working parts that keeps growing. Mm-hmm. And there's an AI company called Mindspring that artificial intelligence. It's going to be the vocal, the first demonstrator project is going to be aboard the orbiter. They've got many, many more plans for it, but their ultimate idea is to have a handheld as the internet and wirelessness spreads around the globe, have a handheld tutor that speaks in any student's own language that connects them to the cloud-based database, so that anywhere in the world, class and economy and infrastructure are no inhibition to any student being able to, you know, learn what they need to learn. Any student around the world could have a tutor in the palm of their hand.
That's awesome.
And about paradigms. So that's just like one of the threads that was not part of Sean's original idea to honor Enterprise and Star Trek and Gene Roddenberry and all hopeful science fiction.
A universal translator.
Stepping into the future. Yeah. But stepping into the future, and it's such an attractive, and Star Trek is a catalyst for so much of what's pushed, you know, all the thinkers and designers and science, you know, Elon Musk and Richard Branson and all these guys who are pushing the envelope, who entrepreneurs who are being Tony Stark, hopefully without the
right,
without the bad weapons.
Now you're mixing genres.
we can cross things all day. Yeah. But that's enterpriseinspace.org. If you guys haven't heard, and maybe sometime I can even come back, and we've done some podcasts with some of the team just to talk about that. I'd love to come back sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's grown so much, and it's been talked about for 2 or 3 years, but it's been a bootstrapper that's about to hit critical mass and go, and it's kind of like Con of Wrath. If you've heard me talk about it often, people have heard me talk about it for 2 or 3 years. I'm kind of the lead outreach spokesman for the con world and the fandom world, and with celebrities, and a lot of people have endorsed it. Nichelle Gracely before she died, but Buzz Aldrin and it's officially a project of the National Space Society, which is like the Planetary Society. It's like the oldest grassroots citizen pro space development, support NASA and Congress, you know, support space at the UN kind of grassroots group. And this is the first big hardware project they've gotten behind, but it'll actually be an orbiter in orbit in 4 years. So we have the engineering side of it. We have the education outreach side, which is the volunteer outreach side. And it's just an awesomely, you bog down talking about it, but the core of it is, you know, just honoring our science fiction, science fact past by going into the future and sparking all these young minds with the current thinking and the current technology and in a lot of new and different ways, and honoring that, and honoring Star Trek, and honoring, like I said, the first real enterprise in space, which is where the name comes from.
That's cool.
So that's that. That's my big thing. But the other thing is the other thing I'm really proud of and putting a lot of time into on my own is Portal 47 that I mentioned. So it's a But I just had years of wanting to take all my Star Trek stuff in my head and the people I knew and the stuff sitting in boxes and get it out to fans faster than the clock was allowing, and that books and conventions and even podcasts were allowing, you know, and magazine articles, and just doing something, connecting the dots and looking at things in a different way and getting voices in that people have not heard. So that's been a big part of what I've tried to launch that a year ago, portal47.net. I say it's like a mini con all year long. There's about 8 components every month, things out of my archives. We have live events when I'm at a con near people. There's touring options here where people, one day tours when people are in LA. But the big part is online, so I can be global. And we've got people in England, people in Australia, and Americans. And I just launched, so it's still evolving. But it's awesome. I say it's for new fans, it's for old fans, it's for bored fans, and it's for fans that have no idea how much about Star Trek they still, how much Star Trek they don't know is still out there and they haven't seen. So voices from up and down Star Trek that you're not going to see in a magazine or here at a convention. Although I'm about to launch a new level called Deck One. And it'll kind of take Portal 47 to a whole new high. But yeah, so portal47.net, check it out. And we just had the first anniversary. I had Robert Butler, who directed The Cage, on. I had a big public open house. Mm. So that was awesome, too. So,
where does the number come from? Am I missing something? The 47.
I'm just going to tell you. We got to go here. I know. But yeah. If you don't know about 47, you just need to look up 47 in the saga of Pomona College.
Okay.
The significance of it's the most common random number in the universe. Interesting. How about that?
Okay.
Wait, I thought it was 42. I guess that's
No.
That's
Rick Berman said 47 is 42 adjusted for inflation.
Right.
No, we blame a math professor at Pomona College, the student body there, Joe Manosky being an alumni, and Joe Manosky coming to Next Generation for bringing 47 to Star Trek. Didn't start with Star Trek, but it surely got the most famous. It surely blossomed in the world view on Star Trek.
That's cool.
So yeah, so I had to call it that, and Portal being a gateway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we could go on and on for hours, but you know what? I think we'll do a follow-up
with
you.
That's good. My wife is needing me to go have lunch. Okay, we'll do that. Yep. And I'll set some of the Enterprise and Space guys.
So, Larry, where can the listener find you online?
Oh, it's probably too much. No, LarryNemechek.com, which is just getting a redesign. So it looks like it's from this century. That's kind of the hub. Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook and at Larry Nemechek on Twitter. Oh, and I now have Instagram, Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Instagram. And all of my Con of Wrath has a Facebook page. Portal 47 has a public Facebook page. The members have a private page. And Trekland Trunk, which is where I have archival. I didn't even mention that. Archival things that I let go, hopefully in a non-slimy way, to those who are interested. If you're interested in getting scripts and set blueprints and first drafts and wacky doodle promotional studio things like that and old retail stuff, that's Trekland Trunk on Facebook.
Beautiful. Thank you. We look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thank you guys for having me on. Yeah.
It was a pleasure.
Once again, thank you very much to Larry Nemechek for joining us on Technorama today. We want to thank all of you lovely listeners for listening to this and our Patreon supporters for supporting us. If you want to be a Patreon member, go to patreon.com/Technorama podcast. Various donation levels, and you get special content that nobody else does. You can also give us your feedback on the listener line, 707-530-CHAT. That's 707-530-2428. We would love to hear you and possibly put you on the show. Keep it clean, keep it short, and we'll hear from you. Send us your email, technorama@chuckchat.com. What did I miss, Craig? Facebook
101?
Page.
101?
Yeah.
Yeah, a Facebook page.
Okay, now give us the binary high five.
Okay, now is it my turn?
Now it's your turn.
101.
Well done.
I don't know why I'm looking at the camera.